Welcome to Wellness Radio with Dr. Jeanette Gallagher as your host. Her show discusses topics of health, wellness, and spirituality and is about discovering your place in this great universe from your cells to the cosmos. Along with her guest, in casual conversation, she strives to ask the difficult questions that may be holding you back from a vibrant life and shares new ideas that may inspire you to make a change in your life that you only can see in your dreams. And now, here is Dr. Jeanette Gallagher.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the show, Alternative Medicine and Wellness. This is Dr. Jeanette Gallagher, and it's a pleasure to have you with us here this evening. Tonight, we are going to be talking about a really interesting topic. The name of the book is called Psychological Nutrition. So now you think, oh, we're going to be talking about how my brain or my mind is going to say about how I'm going to eat. Nope. What we're going to be talking about is how does your brain work? How do your emotions and your feelings work in your life? How is your life playing out so that it's something that you want? It's not something that you're a victim of or a martyr of. It's something that you're not always controlling and directing down the street either. It's really how can you find that balance? Definitely, there's been a lot of things going on these days. People are saying, I'm having so many challenges. I can't quite say that I've had a great day for like the past 10 years. And you have to challenge and say, did the sun come up? Did your kids have a birthday party? Did you buy some new clothes and you felt great? Or what about that it was just a great vacation you had last year? And to be able to recognize those little things for what they are and still understand that life does have challenges, it's just how are we going to be taken down by them? And are we going to be constantly, as I say, it's almost like, you know, when the horse is going down the street. Here in New Orleans, we have horses on the street all the time. You know how they have those bags that are hanging behind them? Well, you know, every time you have a bad day, it's like you're stacking them up in the bag behind you. And you're constantly just carrying around that baggage and can't seem to let it go. So today, it's all about learning how to let it go and actually seeing where you are. Because when you can see where you are, you can then make a choice. And it's not a choice outside of yourself. It's a choice that you make about how your life is going to be. My guest today is Shobha Srinivasan and Linda Weinberger. They are co-authors of the book Psychological Nutrition. And this book is available currently. The link is on the bottom of today's show page. So thank you so much both for joining me today. It's a pleasure to have you with us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Dr. Gallagher.
Well, Linda and Shobha, I think this is a great topic at this time. I think probably we wouldn't have had this discussion maybe about even a decade ago. Don't you think the world is really changing rapidly and we're paying a whole lot more attention to how we act and interact in the world?
I think that's absolutely true. I think there is a much more sensitivity to how our emotions really contribute, not just to our own psychology, but to the psychology of society. And it can be in a good way or it can be in a negative way. So I think, Dr. Gallagher, you're absolutely on point with that.
Well, you know, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I also think that people today are a little bit more attuned to trying to improve not only their physical health, but their psychological and emotional health as well. So they're looking for that. They're looking for information. They're motivated. And I think that's a wonderful thing that's going on currently.
And also, too, you are both clinical psychologists, so you are able to see how, over the decades, life has changed.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Again, we happen to have this. We are, both of us have been trained as traditional clinical psychologists, and we work in that arena as well. But we have a specialty in forensic psychology, which is applying mental health issues to the law. And that has been also evolving through the years. And in so doing, it's given us a perspective of where people are going, where social policy is going, what are the trends, what are folks thinking about now?
Well, I'll be almost 60, or I will be 60 in June. And what I've seen, I think, yeah, I can think back on the 50s and 60s when women got married, and it was what you did, because that was how you were going to get out of the house, and you had a certain place in life, and you played it out. And if you look at it now, some of these women who are now in their 70s and 80s, which I have clients as end-of-life clients, and they come to me and they say, you know, I was so wishing that, you know, he would have left, kicked the bucket before me so I could have had a life again. Or things like, gosh, you know, my life was never my own. Maybe when I come back again, I'll be able to have what I want. Or I felt so held down by life and I just couldn't seem to get a hold on it. It seems to be moving too fast. I think now, as I can see it over so many decades, so many people are saying, gosh, I just don't know anymore. And I think those words, I don't know, can really be applied to across the board. A lot of people don't know. It used to be in the 70s and the 80s, you know, you had to have a college degree. And then in the 90s, it was how many letters can you put behind your name, you know? And then and now it's like, oh, I want a tiny house and I'm going to go meditate in the woods and I'm going to be okay, you know? So we've come a great distance.
I think women's roles have really changed over time at one level in that there's a lot of expectation that women are going to be in the workforce or we're going to be equal partners in income, in a family, things of that nature. So that, you know, that's different than the kinds of things that Betty Friedan was talking about. So it set up, I think, in some ways, a higher threshold for women. And I hear younger women talk about this, how they feel conflicted because there is this expectation that they're going to have to pull 50% or sometimes more of the income and the responsibilities in a marriage or a life partnership. And yet some of these women, you know, have other desires, maybe want to be a stay-at-home mom or maybe want to develop other aspects of themselves and kind of feel like the feminine revolution in the feminist direction has been a mixed bag for them. So, I found that to be an interesting comment from some of my younger colleagues in their 30s or younger about this whole issue.
I know with myself, my daughter is younger, and she's like, I've got my power path, and I'm on my way, and you know, she can just go through with her bumper things, and then she just knocks them off like flies when they come around. And that is just her way of, that's her path. Yet, you know, when I look at some older generations, I see a lot of elders that have been having domestic abuse in their entire lives. And they're still with these abusers because that was what their belief system was.
Right.
And they're still with them. And you know, you look at it and, oh, gosh, when I go into sometimes nursing homes, it is so profound in there that abusers are also put in there, you know. And I think our life cycles of wanting to change and maybe wanting to see change, sometimes, you know, one person can get really healthy in a family or a certain secular group or community, but it doesn't mean that everybody else is on the same page, too. I think that's really important to note because sometimes it's not everybody's spinning on the same wheel, you know? Yeah. So when one person is really wanting to try to get better, it really sometimes you have to step out of the community, step out of the marriage, step out of the group or whatever it might be to be able to lift up your own, you know, emotions or feelings and be able to be a healthier person, correct?
I think what you're touching on is a very important issue, and it really has to do with our expectations of our lives and what we should see for ourselves. And when we're talking about the older generations, they have very clearly defined roles and expectations. You stayed in the home, you took care of your children, you served your husband, you oftentimes didn't believe or even have the skills that you could possibly leave that abusive husband or that psychologically unsatisfying partner and go out and venture on your own. We really weren't socialized to believe in that way. And that belief has carried over as we get older for so many of these women, the ones you're talking about in their 80s, in their late 70s. They continue to believe, this is my circumscribed role. I shouldn't expect anything else. And there's a fear. There's a fear to change because there's a comfort level with the known. You know, at least I know what's going to happen. I don't have to fear that unexpected. And that's what zaps motivation. It zaps dreaming. It zaps hope. It zaps evolution. And our younger folks, our younger women, our younger generation have seen how the individuals in their 50s and so forth really broke out of that very circumscribed role and expectation and started to dabble in the man's world, started to assert themselves. And we encouraged our daughters to do the same thing. And so now they, in many ways, may believe that the world is their oyster, that they can accomplish whatever they want, and if it doesn't work out well, sayonara, Charlie. I'm on my way.
Right. Don't you think, though, Shoba, maybe also, too, those women weren't also given the tools? I mean, I can look at a 70 or an 80-year-old, and some of them may not have even finished high school. And we would gawk at that these days and say, how is that possible? You know, or to be able to say they may have not been integrated into being able to know how to speak up for themselves and to feel that truth and that security within themselves. Because you really speak a lot about feelings and emotions in your book, and it's really about how can you feel safe and secure when you open your mouth or when you think or when you try to act, correct?
Well, yeah, I think that's definitely true. And probably for older women, they just didn't have the degrees of freedom that we do. In terms of being able to say, as Linda was saying, this marriage isn't working, so I'm out of here. That, you know, just is, you know, for many cultures and ages, just simply not an option. You just, you know, bore it, like you said, and as difficult and as painful as it might be. Although the other part of that, when I was listening to you, Dr. Gallagher, what I was thinking was what Linda and I had recently written about, which is a reflection of our own mothers in a piece that we called Wise Words. And both our mothers would probably fit what you're saying, not in terms of the unhappiness or painful relationship, but in terms of they were stay-at-home moms. They were they didn't have all these degrees behind their name. And in thinking about them, we started to realize they had actually given us all these wise words in ways that we thought were kind of funny or didn't pay attention to. Like I still don't with my mom. She just goes on and on about all these different relatives whom I don't know. And, you know, in the Indian culture, relative means some far-flung person that you may not, you know, have ever met or would ever meet. But in each of those stories, I realized as I listened a little more carefully, there are all these life lessons. And the same with Linda, because her mom was a Holocaust survivor, and she just had some profound lessons about resilience. And there were no degrees behind her name, but those lessons were incredibly powerful. So when I see older women, many of them may not have what we would, you know, traditionally say, or the footprints of, you know, academically sanctioned knowledge, but still do seem to have, I think, a lot of wisdom. And and, you know, and we've kind of grown on their backs, you know, stepping stones to being able to, you know, have a much broader feminine input.
And, you know, I think in your chapter on hoarding, I think of it, you know, people are really sometimes wanting to be success hoarders is what we would call them. And I really call it a collection of letters, you know, how many things can you have behind your name? But also, too, the quest is are you not good enough as you are to be able to start out with? And so many people have struggled with that they had to be better, they had to have more, because their husband told them, because their job wanted it, because the paycheck wanted it, because it's what they thought in their mind was right, or they thought, this is what my path is for society dictates it. And that kind of really leads to a lot of people being very disheartened at many times. We see people with PhDs, you know, as top-level physicists, and they turn around and say, you know, I'm chucking this stuff, you know. I'm going to go plant cucumbers for the next 10 years because it just wasn't in their path. So I think now, I think in this probably last decade, is when we can get in touch with that inner part of us, what is important for us versus what is important for those around us to believe that we should show. In other words, can we be unmasked, as I would call it? Are we willing to be that vulnerable, or do we need to continue to layer on the masks because that's how we interact in the little sandbox we're in?
I think that's a very important concept, because I think, again, what people believe is that I have to be a certain way. I have to present myself a certain way. These, again, are the expectations that I may have or that others may have. And yet, there's no joy in there. There's no happiness in there. There's no feeling of confidence. So many times, people who have these positions of power say, I don't know how I got here, and I feel like a fraud. I don't even know what I'm doing sometimes.
Right.
And that underlying insecurity. And so they try and skirt around an issue, and they try to speak in a more sophisticated way to try and cover the fact that they feel like a fraud. And the issue with all of this is what we are trying to propose in our book, and what we advocate is we want you to look for the interactions, the work, the relationships, the situations that feed your soul, that give you nourishment, that are positive to your growth, and in turn, that are going to have a positive impact on the people who are important to you, your community, and so forth. It's really becoming your true self, your true genuine self, and not expectations of others.
Absolutely. Shobha, did you have something that you'd like to add?
I did. Thank you for asking. The core of our book really begins with this notion of hoarding success, and we call it constipated success because it is such a me-first psychology, and it's constipated because the person keeps tightly to themselves their ideas, credit, opportunity, and they're fed by this important person kind of syndrome, an ego addiction. They're the only ones kind of worthy of attention, and there may be underlying insecurity because of that. That's why they're hoarding. Everybody else is an underling. You don't need to pay attention to them. So they're not really centered on growing other people. And they hoard their success because they're afraid that if they don't, they'll lose it. And we, Linda and I, really believe that this is the strength of women. We are nurturers, and that is the core of who we are. We're cooperative across the life span. Women into their 70s, into their 80s. There's incredible creativity there. I always say, as long as you're alive, you're still in the game. Yeah, there's something there that you can offer, and that we can learn from. And the success hoarding in women who are successful and not wanting to give, we think really goes against the feminine spirit.
You know, I can think of many times in some relationships in the past where I've had interaction with, and the men would say, this is the way it is, this is the way it's going to be, you don't do anything for anyone else, you know, they don't do anything for you, or don't waste your time on that, that has no merit, or that's not going to bring anything into you. And I think that's where we're seeing a revolution of divorces probably in the past 10 years is women are finally saying, they're coming out of it saying, you know, I'm sick of listening to your BS anymore and I'm not about to continue to go along that path, you know. Or we see it a lot in the media, you know. People are saying, you know, my husband's been, you know, he has a wandering eye or whatever you want to call it. And they're finally saying, you know what, I've just about had it. You know, it's just done. So I think women are coming out of that now and they're saying, you know, my power is just as equal, if not more, because I'm not allowing that negative energy to bring me down. Because that negative energy, I mean, you just got to say, you know, dude, I'm just over this. And I think a lot of people are starting to say that, I'm over this. We see it with the revolution of people with their jobs. We see it with people giving up houses. We see it with people saying, you know, I feel like I have to explode. I have to grow. I have to expand. And that's really taking you out of that oneness and that shutdown and saying, I need to open up and expand into the world, which is really what the topic of your whole book is all about.
Yeah. I think talking about those sorts of issues when you were bringing up the husband, the man who is saying, well, you have to be this and you have to be that and I expect you to be that, in many ways, and not to be negative and stereotyping, but that is a male-centric point of view. That's the point of view of life is competition and I have to be the winner. And if I am telling you what your roles are and what I expect of you, I'm in control. I'm the one who's the boss. You're the underling. I have conquered this relationship. And women are saying, wait a minute. Why can't we be cooperative? Why can't we work together to make things work? Why do you have to be the boss? Why do you have to dictate to me? And women come from that natural cooperative instinct. They're not looking to be the winner. They're looking to share. They're looking to have people with whom they interact grow and evolve and be supported. And so finally, when the woman says, you're not meeting my natural needs, let alone if, God forbid, you're abusing me emotionally or physically, I don't need to be here. I am really being subjected to your competitive, aggressive nature. And I really don't need that.
And don't you think also, too, the revolution of the entire earth is all about the feminine energy coming forth now? We're all talk about, you know, Mother Earth, how it's time to start taking care of her. And that's really about feminine energy and nurturing of the planet and nurturing of those people and things around you as they will not show up anymore. In other words, male energy tends to be a consumer. Female energy tends to be a nurturer and a reproduce and taking care of.
I think is definitely good point. And there, we do have these two different ways of being, male or female, feminine or masculine, and they are different, very different. And Linda and I also have been very careful to say that we're not trying to forward a male-bashing philosophy because
Correct.
We like men, but the thing is, we're not men. You know, we really
Right.
are different. And in thinking about this, we were realizing that, you know, women in businesses, just in life and the way you take care of the environment, we have gone towards this male-centric way of thinking probably because power has been with men. We value and give esteem to people in power, and the people in power have been men, and therefore we want to emulate them and take on those sorts of attributes. But in doing so, you really are putting on an outfit that is either too big or too tight, or in some way just doesn't look good for you, a psychological outfit. And that's where we're trying to really forward this idea that the feminine divine, entrepreneurial altruism, actions that are driven by a cooperative spirit, are ones that can be very, very powerful. And maybe it's time to switch our eyes away from that competitive way of looking at things to the more nurturant, cooperative spirit. And I think in terms of like taking care of the environment, I've been very taken by the Native American or Indian philosopher John Landier. And he wrote many, many a moon ago about this, about when you stop having a sense of relationship to the earth, the things that you take from it, you start to live this life that's a no life. And he compared that to the life of cattle on a farm to the life of a wild buffalo. The wild buffalo is in tune with nature. The cattle that's in the farm is not. And so I think that may also speak to what you're saying.
I think it's really also, we've spoken many times on this radio show about the yin and the yang of the climate, the yin and the yang of culture and society. And it's really that the male energy of always consuming and never reflecting in which they came from needs to be toned down a little bit. The feminine, that they're over-nurturing and over-giving, but not also bringing into themselves, needs to be also brought up a little bit, which is really bringing us to that balance. You know, when you were just saying that about the cattle, I thought, gosh, I can remember in the 60s when they started putting signs on the interstates. I lived in New York at the time. And it would say, if you litter, we're going to fine you. And it's like litter these days. People don't even think about that, to throw litter out their window in their car. But, you know, in the 50s and 60s, people did that. If they had something in their car, they opened up their window and threw it out. And I'm thinking, how far have we really come, you know, about we are learning. It's just, where in the cycle are you?
Yeah, exactly. I think it really is having this notion of not being so self-centered. I'm going to do things that make me feel good and not have any concern about the impact it may have on another. So if I've got stuff in the car and I want to get rid of all those cigarette butts, I'm going to open up my door in the parking lot, empty out the tray, and move along my merry way, not thinking about that, what an obnoxious thing to do. And the next person who parks there and then steps into all these horrible cigarette butts, what kind of a feeling? What are you saying? Whereas you're going to say, you know what? I don't want to be an inconsiderate person. It's not going to kill me to wait till I get home and empty this out and put it in the right receptacle rather than the ground. It's just, again, focusing on others, focusing on our earth, thinking about the future, thinking about what we are going to leave to our children and our grandchildren. What kind of an earth? What kind of a society? What kind of morals and values are we demonstrating in our everyday life?
You know, I think at the time of reflection for people is they say, well, I'm going to reflect, I'm going to go meditate. And even now they have those pods where you can go into and they will, you know, shut out the world for 20 minutes for $45, and you're going, okay, but when you get out, you're the same, you know what, as when you went in there. You know, you've really just, that was so self-centered because you only cared about yourself. You didn't care about changing your world around you, you know. So there's so many different ways that we're able to do this. You know, let's talk a little bit about your book where you talk about psychological nutrition labels. Let me tell you, this is a very interesting book, very light reading. Again, the name of the book is Psychological Nutrition. And it's so interesting because you really take things to a different way so people can understand it. And what I loved is when you said about the 7 days at a plus or minus in your emotions, because I've been working with this one particular client, and he has gone to emergency rooms and to doctors, had alternative therapies and treatments. He's had medical ones, all kinds of tests, all kinds of drugs, and every single time, within 10 minutes after taking a drug or a therapy or a treatment, you would say, "How do you feel?" And the answer would be, "It didn't fix it." And you're going, "Oh, my goodness gracious. Do you not see any degree of change in life? Do you not see any good in anything?" And I think sometimes people will say, "My day was horrible," just by the end result of your day versus how good your morning may have been, or how good, if you noticed your morning, your afternoon could have been.
Yeah, that I think is because we, like your client, unconsciously take in negative emotions all day long. And when you're bloated with negative emotions, which we call high fat emotions in our book, then it just does not allow for taking in anything positive, which we call low fat emotions. And the 7 day snapshot that you had mentioned is a method really for people to assess where they are on a kind of moment by moment basis. And we had asked people basically to do a diary, no big deal kind of thing, because everybody's busy and nobody wants to do a whole nother thing that's complicated. So it's just a very simple thing that we test drove ourselves to make sure that it was doable, which it is. And it takes one period of 7 days, and for each day you basically record an emotional reaction, the trigger, and its value, was it positive or negative? We give more details about how to do that, but that's kind of the template of it. And you really want to know how many high-fat versus low-fat emotions do you experience in a day. And if at the end of each day and at the end of each week, you're weighted in the direction of these high-fat negative emotions like anger, frustration, resentment, sadness, fear, doubt, things of that nature, nothing you take in as a treatment, as a pod that you go into, a spa, none of that's going to take, because you're kind of marinating in high-fat negative emotions. So that, you know, so sometimes looking at yourself in that way can maybe help move the process of change.
And I think also, too, when you do a 7 day, you can see if there is some sort of pattern. I would always remember Sunday afternoon at 3 p.m. I had four kids on my own, full-time job, still going to college and everything. And it was like, gosh, you know, 3 o'clock Sunday afternoon was a cutoff. It was time to prepare for Monday, you know. And everything after that was, you know, baths, line up the clothes, make sure, you know how that is. I used to have a black day timer, the big ones, and I remember stapling yellow legal pads to each page because I had so much to do that I had just, there weren't enough lines on the page. And we would say, you know, Sunday at 3 p.m., things would start to be okay. Your mood would change, your thoughts would change, and how you started out the week was sometimes a reflection of that. You would say, well, if I had a choice, what would I change differently? Maybe I wouldn't have that job and I could go to school full time. Or maybe I would have a nanny that would be able to ease up some of my worry if I could make it to two places or three places. Or, you know, different things like that. So really the snapshot is will give you an idea of maybe where your hurdles might be or how you could project it maybe forward and say, you know what, this is one thing I don't need in my life and just plain cut it out.
Right. Also, another important thing, I think that's very, very clear. You know, sometimes when you've had a very bad morning, there's just been one thing after another, it starts to snowball. And then you can just have somebody come in and say, well, you know, you're not looking so good. And all of a sudden, you just break down. Now, ordinarily, if you were feeling strong and healthy and you didn't have as many stressors as you had that morning, you'd just go and say, yeah, I know, you know, I didn't get, I changed shampoos and I don't like the way this one makes my hair. You would react at least neutrally, and it wouldn't be devastating to you. But when we talk about this cascade of having one negative emotion after another, which in and of themselves would not be so terrible, but you just see one after the other, you get into a state where even forget another negative event or even a positive statement might change it. Even a neutral one might send you over the top. And that's why it's so important to look at this 7 day, to see if there are patterns. How does your day begin? Each morning, my day begins with this, and it's a negative experience. And then I have another negative, and then another negative. And it only isn't until I've come home, had a glass of wine, sat down, didn't look at the bills, don't want to look at the bills, that I started to relax. And then you can now reassess what your activities are and what changes you could possibly make and what events or people or situations you need to steer away from, because they're just full of high fat emotions, negative emotions that just set off your day for horrible results.
And you also have the next chapters about talking about expiration dates, and we're going through these two or three because I really thought they were great. You had a chapter that says expiration dates, tossing spoiled emotional products from the psychological pantry. And I'm thinking, oh, that is so cool. And I can remember when I was growing up, you had to have cereal and orange juice at breakfast. It was required. You know, I mean, that was just the way it was. And I can remember when I got out on my own, it was like, I'll never eat another bowl of cereal again in my entire life, you know, because I had an expiration date that was never fitting in for me. And I can tell you, as of now, I have not seen cereal, nor have I gone down a cereal aisle in probably, you know, 40, 50 years. So it's really about being able to toss those habits and beliefs out if they don't work for you. They may work for someone else. Or they may be, it may be just be something that was attached to someone else. It would maybe be that, well, it was always your mother that put the cereal there and made you eat it, and you didn't feel good in the morning. And whatever it is, you're able to let go of that. You don't carry around this toxic bag behind you because, as I've always said on the show, is God does not sign for UPS. You can't take this stuff with you. So you've got to learn how to clear it out here. You need to learn to say, I see it, you know, or I feel it or I sense it, and what can I do about that? And that's really what your book is all about.
It is, and I think that's a great analogy with your rejection of orange juice and cereal, because that was a comfort zone and a sameness, and you said, well, it's not something I enjoy. It's not something I want. I'm getting it out of my physical pantry. The analogs of the psychological pantry, there are certain ways of being or behaving that we grow up with that are like the cereal that we hold on to because that's what we've known. That's our comfort zone. And so for some people, anytime they look at or are confronted with change, the first reaction is fear and the second reaction is worry. Because they want to hold on to sameness. They might have grown up in an environment where they've been told, you know, just don't rock the boat. Don't do anything different. You know, just wait for the other shoe to fall. Something bad is going to happen. So that might have been the kind of negative expectancy bias that they grew up with. And so that's in their psychological pantry. But it's not something that serves them well, because they're moving into the world with fear, with doubt, with second guessing. When you do that, no good thing happens. You don't open yourself up to any opportunity. In fact, you close yourself down to opportunity. And so you are now in this psychological prison, this comfort zone, that's really not a comfort zone. It's what we were calling staleness. because the fact of the matter is when you don't change, you are changing. It's like a stagnant pool. Yeah, it may not look like it's changing on the surface, but indeed it is changing. And just like a stagnant pool of water doesn't smell so good after a while, yeah, after a while, if you psychologically imprison yourself with those old habits that are not serving you well, you are going to give out a psychological stink. And that stink is going to be depression, anxiety, sadness, just plain old dissatisfaction with your life. And, you know, our point in psychological nutrition is that all of this is controllable. Just like you control your nutritional intake of food, we really can control our psychological nutritional intake of emotions. It just really means becoming conscious of what we put into our psyches.
The other thing I'd just like to add about expiration dates, and that has to do a lot with relationships too.
Right.
And that is sometimes two people get together and they're really good for each other. At that point in time, they're psychologically nutritious for each other. They're getting positive emotions. They're feeling validated. They're feeling confident. They're feeling secure. They're feeling like they're growing. But time goes on and things change. Maybe your partner changes. Maybe you change. Maybe your friend has changed. Who knows? But after a while, you find out that whatever positive emotions I used to derive from this friendship or this marriage or this work relationship, I'm not getting that anymore, let alone I'm not getting those positive ones. I'm now starting to experience negative ones. And this is what we want people to realize, that with time comes this notion that we evolve, we change. At minimum, we have less time than we did yesterday, perhaps. So that idea of saying sometimes it is best to recognize that this relationship is no longer psychologically nutritious for us, and maybe it's time to either at minimum minimize the contact we have, or at the other end, curtail it, stop that relationship entirely.
Let's look at the women over the age 60, as we would call it. They really are running in fear at the current time. I hear this from women constantly. I'm not leaving him. It's his insurance that I need. I'm not leaving because I don't have the bank account to be able to afford a house. Or a man might say, well, I'm staying because I couldn't take care of all the stuff that she does or whatever that might be. Or I'm not feeling well. See, I had a heart attack last year and my wife is still taking care of everything. She'll have to take care of me. So really those fear mongrels are there and they just get bigger and bigger sometimes as people get older. And I mean, how would each of you, Linda and Shoba, look at that? Because that is a very real fear, especially in the face of insurance changes these days, people with a lot of cancer, or they'll say, I'm going to wait till next year when I go to the doctor. If I have cancer, then I'm not going anywhere. Those kinds of things. People are really using these words and verbalizing it, and it is very forefront in the society these days.
Shoba, you want to begin?
Sure. Well, I would say that it's important to remember that time is a finite quantity, and that we squander it pretty unthinkingly. So if you are looking at your life and there's a lot of unhappiness in it, I think it's time to give serious consideration to how much of the precious quantity of time that you have available that you want to use up on it.
I also think that there are issues that I just can't afford. Where am I going to go? I have nowhere else to go. I have to stay in this relationship as much as I'd like to leave. And this other person is not going to change. So what am I going to do? And I think at that point, it's really important for the individual who's feeling this, trap, and it might be a real trap, it really might, that they need to find some way to bring some positive emotional energy into their life, some hope, some aspect of having control. So maybe they'll have fewer interactions. Maybe they'll lessen the time that they spend with their partner. Maybe they'll find some other activity. You have to, in some ways, acknowledge that sometimes we're doing this. But I think a part of it also is not feeling like you're trapped. Because if you feel like you're trapped, you're giving up. You're not going to do anything to help yourself. You have to look at the situation realistically and say, well, what can I do given the confines and the boundaries of what's going on here? How can I at least feed myself positively? What can I do for myself and still be able to function? And each person has to individually come up with that solution, knowing that, well, then let me get rid of a few of the other negative things in my life, and then maybe I will have the energy to withstand this person who talks constantly and is driving me crazy, or whatever else it might be. And I don't mean to trivialize or minimize this, but we have to look for strategies where we can instill positivity, positive emotions, help, psychological health into our life.
You know, your book being psychological nutrition, I was just liking it to the words. Here in the South, the food is definitely always deep fried, and you go to a restaurant and you say, and for myself, it's like, oh, I don't want to go there because they don't have the food that I'll eat. And my husband is like so sick of hearing that because he grew up on that stuff. That's normal for him. That's always the way it's going to be, period. And I caught myself, the past several, maybe past 8 or 9 years, I would say, okay, I'll go to the restaurant with you. I will just get something else. So, in other words, if I had to eat fried chicken because that's all there was there, I would be able to order a salad if there was, or maybe I would just eat half of the chicken and get a drink and have something else, you know?
But or take off the fried food, whatever there is, yeah.
Yeah, and it's about being able to find that some sort of medium somewhere that you could still take care of yourself. And we tried it for a while, and we said, okay, well, we won't go to your restaurants. Let's go to someplace where I will eat. And he would sit there brooding because he didn't eat in this place. And I looked at it, and I said, well, that's exactly a perfect example of someone who isn't willing to be able to mesh or, be able to adjust themselves to be able to eat in another place. And it would be the same thing you're saying as – to give and take in a relationship, you've got to have some of that. Finally, I just bring my stuff if I want to eat, and it's whatever they're going to do, or else I just don't go. And I think that's really about saying, what can you do? And it's eat before you go, and if they want to go there, let them go there, you know? And doing the best you can in certain situations, because it just doesn't feed your system. It really doesn't. You know, arguing about a restaurant or arguing about your job or arguing about your spouse or money or whatever it might be, there's got to be some sort of a give and take on either side and then find your happy medium, but don't be a victim of it either. Don't be a martyr of it either. You know, he very much felt he was a victim of it. He wasn't going to eat in this place, so he sat there with a face on. You know, I was not a victim or a martyr of it because I was like, oh, well, whatever, you know, and figure out something else. Or eat before you go, or like you said, you know, you take off the skin on the chicken or whatever it might be. So it's about what are you willing to do in this world going forward? And really that's what your book is all about, is what are you willing to do going forward?
Right. And I think a very important thing, again, continuing on your analogy here, is we only have control over ourselves. We can only change ourselves. We try, we think, we hope we can change others. But the reality is, if they don't want to change, they're not going to change. So if you're in a situation when you try and explain, listen, this is something I don't want to do, but I am willing to compromise by doing X, Y, and Z, and the other person says, well, that's not good enough, and starts to pout or starts to carry on, then what kind of a conversation can you have with that individual? They're not willing to be cooperative in this situation, a give and take. And so what you have to say to yourself is, fine, you're not happy with it, that's your problem. This is what I'm going to do. I'm going to compromise to this point. And, you know, I love you, I care about you, but this is as far as I can go. And how you want to react is your choice. You want to pout, you want to get, you know, you want to be frustrated. That's your issue, not mine. And I think women have a real difficult time accepting that they cannot make the world the happiest place on earth. That sometimes people are going to be unhappy no matter what they do. And the reality is you can bend over backward, you can grant them every wish they've ever wanted, and they're still going to be unhappy. Let's be realistic. So I think this whole book about psychological, I know, this whole book about psychological nutrition is focusing on the person who's reading it. It's focusing on yourself, taking care of yourself. Because truth be told, if you don't take care of yourself and feed yourself positive psychological emotions, you're not going to be any good to anyone else. You might think you are, but you're not. You have to be healthy. You have to focus on your own health in order to be able to help others.
And you speak about that in the chapter about being a tool, and I think that's a really great way to bring it up. In closing to the women is, what is a tool? Because people give out and they almost expect it, and you give out and you give out, and then you wonder why you can't. You say, but you're not seeing me, you're not hearing me, are you paying attention? Some women would say, did you hear me? And they would look at you and say, yeah. And then I've even had some women say, what did I say? And they would have no clue. The other people were not hearing. And so if you could share in closing, because I think there's a lot of women struggling with this also about what is a tool and how are you giving out and getting back and not being recognized in your life?
Being a tool is something that I think just comes naturally out of people pleasing. And after a while, you are such a tool in the relationship that you're not a person anymore. You're the one who runs around and does the laundry, make sure the groceries are in there, and you're working full-time, and you're making sure that you're going to all your husband's different parties, and you're doing different things for your kids and their education and so forth, that you get so caught up in that as a tool that you stop being a person to them. You're just a tool, like a hammer is a tool, a car is a tool, and you're not engaging in any kind of genuine way in that relationship. And as a result, you're carrying around a lot of anger, resentment, feeling burnt out, tired because you're doing everything and nobody's ever saying thank you to you. In large measure, it's because, one, they probably didn't ask you to do all of that. You just took it on yourself because you're helpful, Helen. And number two, you're not a person. You're a tool. You don't go around saying, thank you, hammer, thank you, pen, thank you, coffee cup, thank you, stapler. So, you know, this is an insidious pattern that women have. Certainly, I'm guilty of doing this all the time. Maybe psychologists do this even more than other people. I don't know. But,
I think healers do, people who are in the healing professions, the health professions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so you get lost in that. And at a certain point, you know, we have to kind of look in the mirror and say, hey, you know, I'm not getting a thank you because I'm behaving like a tool. Maybe I need to back off and just, you know, maybe other people can run their own lives without my nosy Parker ways, you know, the bewitched Gladys Kravitz syndrome. You're just going to back off and let people be. And that may be the best antidote to being a tool or a helpful Helen.
And I think it's great, you know, if you were always going to be doing the dishes and you're just sick of doing the dishes, just plop some paper plates out there and walk away, you know. I mean, sometimes you just have to sometimes walk away from it and just say, it's just not what I'm choosing, but also to let the others know that you're not choosing to do it anymore. So it's not, because if you expect them to be able to read your mind or to read your signals, not everybody can do that. Sometimes it's best just to put that out there and say, I'm feeling this, this is the way it is, and this is what will occur and what works best for me. So it's really about bringing your power back up and being able to be empowered in how you feel and state your worth and your value.
No question. Communication is so important. And sometimes you can't just do it through subtle little cues and behaviors. Sometimes you have to make statements. You have to talk. Sometimes you have to be pretty obvious and really metaphorically just hit them on the head and let them know until they get it. And they say, okay, now I'm paying attention. Oh, now I see what you want. And I think that's very important. Women are so afraid to assert their feelings and to say how they feel, what's going on with them, because they don't like to express negative emotions. They don't like to be judged. They don't want to make other people feel bad. And in the meantime, they're suffering. And that's just not the way to live your life.
So, Linda, are you saying that when our husband doesn't put his clothes into the laundry basket, that we just let the piles grow and grow and grow and just keep walking over them?
So, when he finds out he has no more shirts and no more socks, wow, I wonder why, you know?
You know, I do the laundry and I put his clothes there, and he just has been piling them up lately. And you know what? The pile is so big right now. And it's like, I pretend my side is fine, and I'm just going to wait until it falls down, and that's his choice. It's also, too, to not be mad about it also, because I'm not mad about it. It's totally his business. It has nothing to do with me. And to just draw the line in your mental and your emotional and your physical being so that, you know, sometimes women will say, oh, well, I'm not going to worry about it, but really they're getting an ulcer, you know, or they're really aggravated and they'll take it out on someone else. That it's really important to say, how can you separate yourself from that? And I'm so totally separated from him, I don't even notice it anymore. But and it's really in his wheelhouse, on his side, and it's his business. And it's really doesn't affect. So just to be sure that when you're making these changes in your emotions and in your life, that you make sure that you aren't squelching them or putting on another mask that says I'm okay with it when you really aren't, because you can really internalize and do a whole lot more damage. Sometimes yelling and screaming might be better than getting an ulcer or cancer, you know. At least you're verbalizing, and then eventually you'll be able to change that verbalizing and saying that's not what I want to do. But sometimes holding it in, what's hidden and what's secret and what's held behind, is what can really eat us personally from the inside out, and that's really the most destructive thing ever.
I agree. Very, very well said.
Absolutely.
Well, guys, I can't believe we come to the end of the show already. It was such a pleasure to have you, Linda and Shoba, with us today. Could you share some information about how to find out more about you and about your book? That would be wonderful.
Well, we have a website, psychologicalnutrition.com. So that's one way to find out about the book and ourselves. Or if people want to get the book, you can just go on to Amazon.com or BarnesandNoble.com. And type in psychological nutrition.
Well, thank you both so much for joining us. Again, Shoba Srinivasan and Linda Weinberger, it was such a pleasure to have you with us here today.
Thank you so much. It was absolutely our pleasure and a delight.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. If you'd like to find out more information about Shoba or Linda, again, the link is on the bottom of today's show page, which will go directly to their website. The book we spoke about today and touched on some of the topics is Psychological Nutrition. And it's really about being able to bring that inner out, because if not, Me being a naturopathic physician, you'll always be seeing me when you hit that wall. Let me tell you, if it will seed in you, and what you hold back and what we hide from others as our truth or as our real being is really going to eat at us, and we're really the ones that will be hurt by it. So really do learn different ways of being able to speak up, speak out. Look at what you're in, see how things are going on around you. If it's not the sandbox you want, change your neighborhood. Get a different sandbox, you know. You can make the changes. So thank you so much for joining us today. This is Dr. Jeanette Gallagher, and until tomorrow, have a wonderful day.
Today we discussed many life-changing concepts. Do you turn to, and how do you know what is best when faced with a health crisis? Dr. Jeanette is a patient advocate. She listens to the patient, the doctors, and the family, clarifies the health issues and concerns, then helps the patient make the best choices going forward. If you would like help implementing change into your life and health, we can talk and see where you are stuck and how to improve the quality of your life. Check the link on the bottom of today's show page or visit www.drjeanettewellness.com to schedule a phone appointment today with Dr. Jeanette Gallagher.